Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. And today I'm delighted to be joined once again by Fabio Vigi. Fabio is a professor of critical theory and Italian at Cardiff University. He also publishes frequently at the Philosophical Salon, and he is the author of several books, including most recently Unworkable: Delusions of an Imploding Civilization, a copy of which I have in front of me, thanks to Fabio, who generously sent it my way. And in short, Unworkable discusses the ongoing implosion of our globalized world from three distinct angles: the capitalist elimination of labor through technological automation, the dissolution of our shared social narratives, and the subtle imposition of an increasingly pervasive ideological order. All three angles, I would say, are quite relevant, quite appropriate to the time we're living in right now, as is what Baudrillard said: all societies end up wearing masks. So, Fabio, welcome to Perspective. How are you doing, good sir?
Hi, Jesse. Great to speak to you again, and thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm fine. Just fighting with the British rain. It's terrible. The weather has turned horrible again, but never mind. Apart from that, I'm fine.
Good to hear. So, something I've been noticing for quite some time, but especially in the past 2 weeks, is this very strong tendency among the political class and their corporate media mouthpieces toward revising history or even outright erasing history. And one example of this is what UK Defense Minister Ben Wallace said on Victory Day for Russia, May 9th, what he said at the National Army Museum in London. And essentially, he said that Russia are Nazis. They will meet the fate of the Nazis, that being the Nuremberg trials. This is a complete revision of history, a fantasy, and one leveled at Russia on one of its most sacred holidays, you could say. And then in the media, we've seen stories like that of the Telegraph, which ran a piece on four women who are supposedly wives of Nazis who were holed up in Azovstal in Mariupol in Ukraine, who've since surrendered. But they went on a tour, even meeting with the Pope, to elicit sympathy for their husbands and to also somehow get them freed in a way where they wouldn't end up surrendering to Russia. And there's a proliferation of remarks by people in the political class and articles like this. And I think it's very much in line with what your book deals with the subtle imposition of an increasingly pervasive ideological order, and what Baudrillard said about all societies ending up wearing masks. And of course, you can take that literally, as we saw with the so-called COVID-19 pandemic. But now there is a much more dangerous, I would say, masking going on, a masking of history. I'm wondering if you've noticed this phenomenon too.
Yeah, I have noticed it. I think it's kind of infuriating when you hear those stories that you were mentioning, and kind of frustrating. But I think it's also interesting to see how the kind of propaganda has increased in recent years, in, I think, correlation with the kind of panic almost that I think the elites are feeling in relation to the economic model being, you know, almost on the verge of implosion. So mm-hmm. I tend to correlate the two things. The more the debt-based, hyper-financialized economic model sort of approaches the precipice and eventually will collapse, the more that they are also kind of rising the propaganda stakes and turning on pumping the volume of propaganda to try and control public opinion. Obviously, the two things I think are linked. They are two sides of the same coin in many ways, and that's what I find interesting from a kind of big picture perspective, a kind of historical perspective. It seems to me that the crisis of capitalism, which is now really kind of kicking in, it's really approaching, I think, the final stage, is met with this ever increasing dose of propaganda, which is, as I said, very infuriating and frustrating. But at the same time, I think it tells us the story. It tells us a story insofar as it's about almost a kind of panicky attitude of the elites, or kind of desperate attitude towards the kind of imploding economic environment. Right? It's almost as if they kind of raised the game over the last 20 years. If you think about it, we started with creating the enemy, for example, right? This classic strategy of creating an enemy to cover for a problem that is very much inside the system and is not external to the system. But obviously, the moment you project all the attention onto an enemy, an external enemy, you take that attention away from the internal limit almost of the system that we're living in. So I think this strategy has been working for 20 years or so, since Al-Qaeda, there's obviously the Taliban, and there's a number of enemies that we've kind of constructed. But now, since COVID, since 2020, that enemy has gone fully global and has taken on a different dimension altogether, right? It's a much bigger picture that we're seeing, and as we discussed before, it's now really a matter of a kind of continuous streak of threats, of traumas, of enemies, of propaganda that we must perceive as external, as and as contingent, as something that has happened almost by accident or by some evildoer like Putin, obviously, but that has nothing to do with the way we've created, this kind of socioeconomic condition of kind of extreme fragility. I think the two things are really kind of correlated, and it's interesting to see how, the more the risk of collapse increases, the more we have this kind of propaganda creating enemies, and the two things go together basically.
Yes, I agree. And your work has been very instructive for me in coming to that discovery for me. And the more I read your work, the more it makes sense. And I'm looking here at a chart of the Federal Reserve's, the U.S. Federal Reserve's quantitative easing since 2014 at the chart I'm looking at. But right now, the Federal Reserve's assets are almost at $9 trillion. So it's been buying up assets to pursue quantitative easing for quite some time now. And if you look at this chart, you can see that it starts to shoot up almost vertically around late 2019, and then really takes a vertical ascendance in early 2020. And then this is broken down to show what the assets are. And far and away, securities held outright comprise most of the assets. Yeah. There is no gold to be seen. And after assets, liquidity and credit facilities, I believe it is, are the next biggest category. And we've heard announcements from the Fed that they're going to pursue quantitative tightening, and they're raising interest rates, at a rate that hasn't been seen since 2000. But again, I think this is what they're saying about quantitative tightening and raising interest rates. It's again more masking this huge QE asset buying problem.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any way to reverse this, no matter how much they finagle the interest rates and tell the public that inflation is due to rising fuel prices, not the fact that rising fuel prices are the result of inflation.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right. I think it's a game they're playing at the moment between quantitative tightening and quantitative easing. So I think that what's going on is that they're using inflation to deflate. That's the paradox that I think it's important to underline, that inflation really is a transfer of wealth from bottom to the top, right? Mm-hmm. So inflation kind of takes money, it robs us of money, because it erodes our purchasing power. So the value that we hold decreases with inflation, but at the same time, it also devalues the bond bubble. So it actually serves a specific purpose for states, so far as they have a kind of their debt effectively shrinks, right? So it has a specific function insofar as it deflates the debt bubble. But I think this deflation of the debt bubble will be followed, and also the kind of quantitative tightening that goes with it, the kind of reduction of the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, is only going to be followed by further quantitative easing, more programs that will inundate the system with the liquidity it needs to carry out its kind of financial speculation. So mm-hmm. it might be a different name. We might not get the same name, quantitative easing. It might be called in a different way. But I think it will soon come to follow the current regime, which is one of slight hikes of interest rates and slight quantitative tightening. I think this will come pretty quickly, maybe already in mid-August at the usual bankers conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And it might be announced even there or a little bit later in the autumn. And it might also need a nudge from a controlled accident of sorts, a kind of geopolitical accidents that will justify, legitimize further injections of liquidity into the financial system, through the usual way, by purchasing mm-hmm. assets, exactly the way you've described it. Right. They are, as we said before, they're really caught between a rock and a hard place. They need to pretend at least that they're doing something against inflation, but at the same time, they can't stop the liquidity programs. If these liquidity programs, central bank liquidity programs, were to end, we would see a rapid increase in key interest rates that would immediately threaten a market crash mm-hmm. and defaults across the globe, right? So that would be, I think ultimately that's the real trauma that they are currently avoiding. They're sort of hiding behind geopolitical and biopolitical events like COVID and Putin's war. because what they really are afraid of is the popping of the debt market, the bond market, which would immediately also affect the the stock market, and that would be catastrophic for the economy as such. So I think what we're seeing is this kind of desperate, I go back to that word, desperate attempt to defer the moment of truth, as it were, right? The kind of the moment of reckoning where effectively this house of cards that we've been building over the decades, let's remember that this is not something new. It has been exacerbated, of course, by recent events like COVID and Ukraine, but it has been there for a long time, right? The system has created huge amounts of liquidity that are not covered by real accumulation in the real economy. That's the fundamental point that people need to understand, right? All this money supply, it's been created out of nowhere from economic nothingness, has been added into the system, and that is money that doesn't come from the basic elementary mechanism of the capitalist system, which has to do with money capital investing in the labor force to create a surplus value, to create more wealth into the economy. That's the fundamental fiction that we have betrayed over the last 40 years of neoliberal monetary expansion. And I think today this trajectory is coming to the end. They really are running out of policy bullets. You know, they don't know what to do next. So they are kind of doing a kind of balancing act between kind of deflating slightly the stock market, deflating slightly the debt bubble, even at the cost of quite radical sort of corrections as we're seeing them today in the market. But they will necessarily have to kind of refill the markets themselves. They will have to pump more money into the system very, very soon. And so at the moment, I think they're just trying to kind of this balancing act. But I don't think they're going very far with it. This is the very last stage of a terminally ill system, I think. As I said, in the 70s and 80s, we still had a way out of the stagflation. Stagflation in the 1970s was fought precisely by the neoliberal sort of strategy of hiking rates, etc., and even if that caused widespread recession, and obviously huge debt problems especially in the periphery of empire, and talking about Latin America particularly, but now they don't have that. They've already used that card, right? They've already used this sort of monetary card of inflating the system with fictitious money, and that's why I think they are kind of desperate to use the kind of geopolitical or biopolitical emergency card. So we are now into this kind of emergency capitalism, as I call it, because it relies on the desperate creation of an external threat, like a virus, obviously, like with COVID, and like Putin. To fight which we are ready to sacrifice everything almost. Well, we must be ready to sacrifice everything. That's what we're told. Hence all this money that is being spent to pump weapons into Ukraine, for example. It's fascinating how it really doesn't serve the purpose that it's supposed to serve, that we're told it's serving. It's nothing to do with Ukraine, ultimately. I think the fundamental point, the fundamental enemy is, for them, the fundamental threat is the potential bursting of the debt bubble and therefore the market bubble, because this bubble is becoming more and more, it's getting out of control. They don't know how to control it any longer. And
so I want to...
Yeah. Sorry.
I want to get into that further to bring Ukraine into this conversation and also some other countries, namely Turkey, where inflation is at 70%, and try to expand on what we're talking about here. But we need to throw it to a quick break. So more with Fabio Vigi after this.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Election 2022, and Australia decides on the 21st of May.
The government's response to COVID-19 has been a sledgehammer approach, which has not factored in the consequences of placing human life as we know it in lockdown. The government is simply out of touch with the needs of Australians. Purely looking at the reduction of case numbers has decimated our way of life, and it is the goal of the Liberal Democrats to return Australia into a sensible, rational, and free country. Hi, I'm Crystal Mitchell, your Senate candidate for the Liberal Democrats in Victoria, and I've been fighting the lockdowns and the state emergency legislation since I spoke out against the disproportionate responses as a Victorian police officer. I'm here to tell you that your life, family, and work are not to be flicked on and off based on the whims of the government. In this video, I want to talk to you about the first policy in the Liberal Democrats' Freedom Manifesto, freedom from COVID alarmism. The Liberal Democrats believe that the Australian people are smart enough to make their own health decisions. The Freedom from COVID Alarmism policy will make several immediate changes. These include opening the schools. Closing schools decreased the severe COVID risk on children from zero to zero. Not only that, 2 years of our children's education was ruined. Ending the lockdowns. We've been fighting these lockdowns since day one, and if we're elected, there will be no more lockdowns ever again. Legalising peaceful protests. Protesting is a human right. We should never be punishing people for standing up for what they believe in at a peaceful assembly. Protesting is a part of our democracy, and it should be protected at all costs. Making vaccines available, voluntary, but not mandatory. With rapid antigen tests available, it doesn't make any sense that every person, regardless of their health status, should be jabbed. Ending the mask mandate. Masks should be voluntary. It is only right that the individual chooses how they manage their health and that we do not use coercion to force people into a way of compliance with health orders. Allowing Australians to get home from abroad. Removing the border closures and travel restrictions. It's not okay that Scott Morrison took a private jet to cross a state border to spend Father's Day with his kids while everyday Aussies were not allowed to see each other. We want to remove contact tracing and QR codes, remove social distancing, remove mandatory self-isolation, and end all emergency powers. What will this policy mean for you in the long term? It will mean that you will have certainty that your business will not be arbitrarily closed or have crippling restrictions. It will mean you can plan your dream wedding without worry. It means that you can see your family and friends who live overseas or in another state. It will mean being able to say a dignified goodbye to loved ones in person and with those that loved and cherished them. Finally, it means that you will not be pressured by the government to take any medications or procedures that you are not comfortable with. In response to the horror of the last 2 years, we are calling for an immediate investigation into Australia's COVID-19 response. The Liberal Democrats will hold the government accountable. We will never lock you down. We will never shut down your businesses, and we will never make medical decisions on your behalf. To find out more, go to ldp.org.au.
Authorised Jay Humphries, Matt Wadley, Victoria.
For the news and views you can't hear anywhere else, it's TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell, and I've been speaking with Fabio Vigi. Fabio is a professor of critical theory and Italian at Cardiff University and the author of several books, most recently on Workable, Illusions of an Imploding Civilization. And we've been talking about an imploding civilization, I would say, so far this hour. And Fabio, I wanted to pick up where we left off with what you were saying about this being capitalism's terminal phase. And no, there's really no going back from here. There's no mitigation that can be done to reverse this. This is something that is not just plaguing Western nation states. Yeah. It's also playing out in countries like Turkey and Lebanon and Sri Lanka. It seems to be going global, so to speak. Turkey inflation is at 70%, but meanwhile, Erdogan is busying himself with opposing the entry of Finland and Sweden into NATO, really making no mention in his pressers of the huge inflation problem in Turkey. Lebanon is being tortured to death by the U.S. in concert with the World Bank, who are refusing to let Lebanon receive energy that's ready to go from Egypt because it would have to be transferred through Syria, and there are sanctions on Syria through the so-called Caesar Act. And this is just adding to the already destroyed Lebanese economy and society that is suffering in more than just economic ways. And then, you know, Sri Lanka, we saw the president or prime minister, I'm forgetting which one, I think it was the prime minister, step away from his post amid, you know, the blowback that inevitably comes from the restructuring and the control of IMF monetary and financial policies. So again, this is a global implosion, so to speak. And I'd just like to get your take on that.
Yeah, I think I always think that the geopolitical events that we're witnessing, you know, very tragic in many ways, are, I always use the word derivatives, you know, to use a financial term, derivatives of the larger problem with the economy. So I tend to think of whatever is happening on the geopolitical chessboard as a almost inevitable now consequence of this crisis, which is coming in now not as a normal capitalist crisis, I don't think, insofar as it's not a question of boom and bust any longer. You know, I think we really are approaching the final moment, the final crisis, which appears to be this in the form of a massive devaluation shock, fundamentally, right? That is kind of represented by inflation today. You know, inflation is nothing but the devaluation of the money medium, fundamentally, right? Which is affecting everybody in one way or another. You know, Turkey is particularly obvious, and maybe that's the reason why they are trying to mediate that. They're obviously trying to mediate in a very kind of politically opportunistic way. They will have their demands. They will try to do obviously something which eventually benefits them as a NATO country, but also I think aware precisely because of how inflation is destroying their society, aware that the kind of system that you were talking about before, the kind of the dollar system, basically, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about, the kind of, it is not working anymore. It's causing more damage than benefits, and it's been doing so for a long time, particularly in the periphery of the global system. So I think we are, and I think this awareness is an awareness that it's not only the awareness of the periphery or of those countries, you know, the BRICS, etc. It's also an awareness that is emerging from within empire, from within the Western, sort of globalized world, and it's almost as if we are driving towards this kind of new Cold War, which it will work as a kind of mother of all emergencies, as it were, right? The big emergency after a series of emergencies and threats that we've seen over the last 20 years. You know, I mentioned Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, mm-hmm. Islamic State, Syria, mm-hmm. North Korea. Then there was the trade war with China, Russiagate, of course, and eventually COVID-19. Now it almost appears as if what is needed for this kind of failed, bankrupt, globalized world to defer its implosion is precisely a new Cold War. You know, something mm-hmm. like a permanent enemy. The idea of a permanent enemy that can justify, legitimize the fundamentally the production of more debt, the creation of more debt to sustain the financialized economy. So mm-hmm. I think that there's a kind of convergence here, both from within empire, as you know, the Western sort of civilization, capitalist civilization, which is reaching, I think, its terminal crisis, and the periphery, that you know, the awareness, an awareness about the unsustainability of the kind of dollar hegemony on a global level. So I think we are going towards a kind of multi, or at least bipolar, multipolar, or multi-currency world. I think it's almost, you know, after this kind of globalization, which clearly failed and it is failing, I think it's inevitable that we will go towards some kind of division, mm-hmm. a kind of division that, again, will serve a very specific purpose. And the purpose it will serve, I think, is that of masking or hiding, concealing the fact that the kind of commodity producing system is itself self-destroying. You know, I think that's mm-hmm. fundamentally the logic we're looking at anymore. So the creation of the enemy has no longer anything to do with the expansion of empire as it did in the past. You know, the kind of immunizing logic that allows empire to expand further, but it's mm-hmm. just a kind of desperate, almost defensive strategy, which has to do with concealing the wound, you know, the deep wound inside the system itself that the system is unable to heal. I think that's right. What we're looking at, you know, and it's as I said before, I think we're really reaching a point of kind of the outer limit of expansion. Even if it's really a lot of people saying that this is about destroying Russia and then getting to China next, I think it's more of a kind of re-territorializing strategy, right? Mm-hmm. An attempt to create an enemy that would guarantee a division to be there for a long time, that in turn would somehow justify, you know, further debt creation and God knows what else, you know, in terms of impoverishments of populations, you know, control of populations, and eventually perhaps, you know, as we all know, the Great Reset, you know, based on a fully digital infrastructure of monetary slavery. I mean, I think ultimately this would be the only solution. We will, in that case, obviously enter an almost neo-feudal you know, stage, which, you know, mixed with you know, with capitalist characteristics, as it were. But so I think that's what is going on, and that's what, you know, all the players on the geopolitical chessboards are becoming aware of this of this intrinsic kind of implosion. You know, the fact that the mm-hmm. system itself is reaching its last legs, as it were.
Right. And something you and I talked about in our last conversation is that, yes, it seems inevitable that a new geopolitical order will emerge. It seems that it is emerging, and it seems likely to be multipolar, but it's still going to be based on the same economic system that is imploding right now. It just hasn't, it's not starting fresh, but you know, if you look at Russia's debt to GDP ratio, it's somewhere around 19%, whereas the US's a conservative estimate is about 130%, right? Yeah. So Russia's starting at a much lower point, in a sense, with this new order, but it's only going to exacerbate from there, because it's working on the same model that is imploding right now for Western Empire. Yeah. So that's why I haven't really been sanguine, as a lot of people have been, about the emergence of this new multipolar order, because it's not really new, despite its multipolarity.
No, I totally agree with you. There's nothing to be optimistic about here. I really don't think so. Insofar as the system remains sort of based on the same categories, on the same logic, on the same sort of capital form of wealth, then we know that way of creating wealth is now counterproductive. You know, it's not productive of wealth anymore. It only produces money without value, right? Money that is not covered by real value. That's the fundamental point that I'd like to repeat, because, you know, we think that money is value, but money is not value. Money is the kind of exterior face of value. It's the kind of the surface of value, or a representative of value. Value is created in the real economy by putting people to work. You know, in a capitalist system, that's how value is created. And the mechanism of value creation has stopped working a long time ago, probably about 3-4 decades ago, in conjunction with the Third Industrial Revolution, where laborers, where workers were increasingly deprived of labor, precisely because machines were taking over, technological automation was taking over more and more. And that process now is uncontrollable, and therefore, you know, it's not as if there are some bad people here who want to destroy the system. It's the system itself that is heading towards self-destruction, because it works through money and liquidity, but this money is deprived of its basis in value. It's more and more deprived of its value substance. And therefore, it creates this disequilibrium. This kind of devaluation shock that we're seeing today, and that the elites are unable to manage fundamentally. Right? This is crisis management. What we're seeing fundamentally with the geopolitical situation is an extreme form of crisis management. You know, of economic crisis management.
Yes, and it's primarily manifesting in spasms of violence, whether it's the pumping of weaponry
into Ukraine. It's increasingly violent, increasingly criminal, and increasingly cynical. You know, cynical insofar as it's, we are told, the opposite of what's going on, right? We're told that it's really about Putin, that it's really about virus, that is really about, but the actual fact, what they're not telling us, it's really about hiding the problem at the heart of the economic system, which is a value creation problem fundamentally.
Right.
To an extent,
I was just going to say, I suspect if Lacan were still with us, he would have something to say about the transference going on here.
Yeah, there is. I think it's also a matter of projecting onto the enemy the evil that is at the heart of the system itself, right? It's a transference mechanism in that respect. You're projecting onto the other the problem that lives inside you, you know. And I think that's the way in which kind of Western capitalist system has always operated. But now it's becoming more and more desperate. The situation is becoming more and more desperate. So we need more and more enemies, you know, to compensate for it, because they don't really know what else to do. They don't really have another you know, policy bullet, as I said earlier, to play. They don't have another card to play. And this is what makes it interesting, because I think it's from this sort of radical crisis that something new might emerge, right? Precisely because when the system is implosive as it is today, then slowly, spontaneously maybe, or, you know, whichever way it will happen, a new way of organizing our social lives, a new kind of even ideology regarding social reproduction will emerge. And that's the kind of only hope that we can have, right? That we don't end up in a long, you know, in a long period of kind of biopolitical neo-fascist and also neo-feudal society, because that would be
There and there do seem to be some pockets of resistance from some quite unlikely places, or seemingly unlikely places, and I want to get into that in our last segment, but we have to throw it to a break once again. Stay tight. More with Fabio Vigi here on TNT Radio after this.
Election 2022, and Australia decides on Saturday, May 21st. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
Although opinion polls for months have indicated that the next Prime Minister will be Anthony Albanese, and I must say this still seems likely, it appears that Scott Morrison still has some chance of keeping his job. The latest Resolve poll shows a significant collapse in Labor's vote, and they only marginally lead the coalition on a two-party preferred basis. Many voters are very angry with the major parties and their collective lack of vision. A reliable political operative has informed me that in 2019, pollsters had to canvass three people to get one completed survey response. But this year, pollsters need to speak to seven people to get one response. This indicates that anything is possible, including a massive vote for freedom-loving minor parties and independents who have fought against COVID medical tyranny. The outcome will be particularly interesting in the Senate. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
When you remember this year's holiday, will you think of the waves gently lapping on the shore? The sun setting over rolling hills? Or sat bored out of your mind with a flat tire waiting for a recovery truck? One in five motorway breakdowns are caused by tire problems. Before you set off, check your tire pressure. Highways England.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Do citizens make decisions based on evidence and reason? Or are they manipulated by behavioral economists applying nudge theory? In 1992, the Rockefeller-controlled Russell Sage Foundation launched the Behavioral Economics Roundtable. In 2008, two members of the roundtable, Cass Sustain and Richard Thaler, co-authored the book Nudge, which led to widespread government adoption of nudge theory through the Behavioral Insights Team. Also known as the Nudge Unit, launched in the United Kingdom, the Behavioral Insights Team now has offices worldwide, including in Canada, Latin America, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Singapore. The Nudge Unit boasts to have trained 20,000 civil servants and practitioners in behavioral insights. Supported by taxpayer funding, subtle messaging techniques nudge populations to normalize behaviors and attitudes deemed appropriate by nameless, faceless bureaucrats. The Nudge Unit plays on people's fears and guilt, It promises rewards for compliance in its projects, such as boosting vaccination rates and reducing energy consumption.
Where progress is influenced by revolution and evolution. This is today's News Talk Radio.
TNT. Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell, your host for this last part of the hour, and I am speaking with Fabio Vigi. So, Fabio, in terms of resistance to this imploding capitalist system, which is glaringly before us, I want to hit on a few examples. So, and again, I'm not so sanguine about all of these examples as I am with the supposedly new multipolar order, but I think it's important to highlight different possible examples of alternatives. But the first one I want to point out, which I think is the most important action we can take as individuals and individuals who come together in small groups, is what the workers at the airport in Italy recently did in refusing to ship weapons labeled as aid to Ukraine. I think that kind of on-the-ground resistance is, it's foundational. You know, that's real resistance right there. You know, it's outside, and it's even pushing back against this imploding monetary system, saying, no, we will not participate in the violence, the financial violence, and the war-oriented violence of this system, just based on principles of humanity. I think those are the examples we need to key in on. But going from there to the, I guess, political class or nation state level, one example is Argentina, where it's struggling with $40 billion in foreign debt. And the president, Alberto Fernandez, he says, quote, this debt was, quote, is, quote, toxic as it was incurred during the administrations of corrupt Western-backed puppet leaders. And he has recently courted China to secure a $40 billion Chinese investment, and it'll include development projects such as a next-generation Chinese-built nuclear power plant. And then in Brazil, we see former president Lula da Silva, he is talking about doing away with the dollar hegemony and establishing a new Latin American regional currency, and also courting China at the same time for development funds. And supposedly this currency called the SUR or S-U-R will be out of reach of the IMF. But again, what gives me reticence, or what gives me pause about these possible alternatives, is that, as we said, they're again going to be based on the same system, the same platform of the system that's imploding right now.
I agree. I mean, the problem is really this kind of awareness, which will probably hit us at some point soon, that the forms of capital are kind of melting away all by themselves. You know, the forms of value, capital is a process. Is a process that money and the market is just one side of it, one part of it. Then there's production, there's the commodity, and so on. And I think all these forms are part of what capital is. And all these forms are slowly but surely melting away. You know, so we need to reinvent other social forms that that can keep us together in a different way. In a healthier way, as it were, as societies. And the difficult thing, I totally realize that, is to let go of these forms that very much inform our identities. Right?
Right.
We are informed by capital itself. It's impossible to deny that. But insofar as capital is dying, we need to let go of that, kind of identification with it. And at some point, they will grow, I'm absolutely certain, you know, new sets of values, right? Not necessarily economic values any longer, or a different kind of economic, or different kind of economy that that will at least point towards a radical alternative to what we're seeing today. Because, you know, as I said, kind of stabilizing this scenario is impossible now. You know, we are really caught between death by inflation or debt by deflation. Both of them are, you know, forms of devaluation of the money medium and of whatever that money medium is representing, which is really the kind of economic values, but also cultural values and also social values of a capitalist society. So I think the point will come and is coming for kind of radical reinvention of what a society is, right? And what a society is driven by. Because, you know, we don't even realize that anymore, but, you know, our society is driven by profit making fundamentally, which has nothing to do with, you know, the distribution of wealth, or it's simply a very anonymous mechanism that, you know, runs in a kind of impersonal way, a kind of blind, you know, drive, really. And that is now, as I said, sort of imploding. So the truth is that, you know, if we are in a kind of lose-lose situation with capitalism today, you know, almost like drink driving towards the precipice, as it were. That's where central banks, particularly with their policies, are taking us. So I don't even think that we can have now the answer, right, to what is going to happen. We can't have it now. It would be delusional to think that we have an answer already.
Right.
But by sort of becoming aware of this negative trajectory, this kind of trajectory that we're following that is coming to an end, by being aware of what is causing, you know, the implosion, then something new can hopefully emerge.
Exactly.
You know, that's all I can say. It's difficult to predict the future. It's impossible to plan the future,
right,
or a future society. But we know, we must know, that it's not going to be driven by the same fundamental values, economic values, that are now causing the destruction of a very painful destruction, right, and potentially devastating, cataclysmic destruction of our society, right? So this is the choice we have today in capitalist term. You know, it's a false choice in a way. As I said, we have a choice between inflation, which means that money is devalued as a general equivalent, or kind of, you know, devaluation by deflation, which is a process that would affect capital as such. So factories, machines, workers suddenly becoming economically superfluous, right? Mm-hmm. So the current choice is inflation, for the reasons that we talked about. But, you know, inflation is certainly, you know, it's now becoming stagflation, incidentally. You know, the misery index is growing, index being the combination of inflation and unemployment. So the unemployment rate. So, you know, it's getting worse and worse. And people are becoming poorer. The middle classes are being wiped out. Where do we go from here? There doesn't seem to be a kind of capitalist solution to this. Right?
No, certainly not.
I think being aware of this is already an important step, I think.
Yes. Unfortunately, we have to wrap, but I do want to underscore that we have to be aware structurally of what's happening, historically of what's happening, and the powers that be, or the powers that shouldn't be, which I think is more appropriate, are doing everything within their capacity to make sure that We don't have a structural
that we don't get, that we don't understand exactly.
Right, right. And I think that's where we're seeing this insane propaganda push that we started out with coming from. And it's all connected. And, you know, the devaluation of currency and debt, that leads to the devaluation of humanity in the end. And we have to figure out how to break away from that. So
just think of
how we have about 10 seconds, but
just to say, think of how inflation today is being blamed on Putin, right? I mean, it's being shamelessly blamed on Putin without real, it's a systemic problem, and yet we blame it on Putin, you know, including, of course, the apocalyptic effect on the poor, as the Bank of England has just stated, of inflation. And it's all Putin's fault, right? This is one way, one very specific way of preventing us from understanding the structural problem.